from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, good evening, good evening, wherever you are listening to us. This is Rated LGBT Radio, and I am Rob Watson. Tonight, we have kind of a boatload of things for you. Really, we are pulling right from the LGBTQ headlines of the week, and we're going to be talking about the different stories, and these stories range from the new career of a mayor in Chicago who is a lesbian. She is just starting on her journey there in that historic win, to another mayor who has been mayor of a town in Indiana who has found himself or propelled himself to the top of the presidential race. And we're going to talk about those individuals and their incredible landmarks. We are going to talk about the boycott of a Bloody King who owns a bunch of hotels in Hollywood and what he has instituted in his kingdom and why the Hollywood elite is now calling for yet another boycott. We're going to discuss that in terms of how well that went the last time they did a boycott of the exact same monarch and the exact same hotels. We're also going to talk about some laws that have been proposed, one in Texas, one in Tennessee, and you guessed it, they are laws that would make LGBTQ discrimination legal in those states, and we're going to examine that. Then we're going to talk about how Grindr is potentially a security risk, although I think it's been accused of making a lot of people feel insecure before, but this is a whole new level of security risk, and we're going to touch on that, plus a whole bunch of other things on this, the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King and Martin Luther King Jr. And so we want to pay homage to that incredibly sad event as well. And with all this, I'm going to welcome to the show my beloved and esteemed co-host, Brody Levesque. Good evening, Brody.
Hey, good evening, Rob. Before we jump into the various headlines and things, I want to give out a couple of shouts and acknowledgments to two of our previous guests from the last year or so. Our good friend Brody Ray will be performing at Miami Beach Pride this weekend, Saturday, April the 6th at 2 p.m. You'll find Brody and his Nashville band on the TD Bank stage in Loomis Park. And then at the end of this month, Arcadian Broad, who is the artist in residence and chief dancer or principal dancer of the Orlando Ballet Company, is staging his very last production with the Orlando Ballet Company called Wonderland, Mad Tales of the Hatter. So if you're in the Orlando area or Central Florida, April 26th to the 28th, I suggest you get your tickets now at orlandoballet.org and go watch what's bound to be an incredible performance by an incredible young, very talented choreography composer, dancer, and amazingly only 23 years old. So that's the end of the month. That's it for housekeeping. Rob, what else we got going on for you? Oh, that's right. Wait, we've got Pride coming up in Santa Cruz in June, don't we? So everybody put that on your calendar.
Yes, yes.
You want to go visit this
yes,
man,
we
you've
do.
Got and, to go to Santa Cruz.
And I want to point out that my jealousy of Miami getting Brody Ray will only be exacerbated if we don't get him here for Santa Cruz Pride, which he has an invitation to play, and stay tuned for more information on that if we get that to come to fruition.
Absolutely. So This week has been an incredibly busy week, especially for those of us in the news business. And this is outside, of course, of the President of the United States declaring that the noise from windmills will give you brain cancer, which is a first.
Okay,
let's
stay on that one for a second. That one is just too. What? I'm going to kill myself for asking this question because I know the answer is nothing. But where in the reaches of his imagination did he pull that out of? Seriously.
I can just hear the collective tightening of sphincters in the West Wing when they were watching the live feed of that speech. I don't know. With this guy, it's just there's no level, there's no bar, there's no threshold, there's no limitation on the nuttiness and the nastiness and the pettiness and the narcissistic and then stuff comes out of his mouth like that, you know. And of course, naturally on Facebook yesterday, everybody was busy marking themselves safe from cancer caused by windmill noise. I'm like, okay, that's fine. This is going to be a meme all day long. Sure enough, guess what? It was.
In all seriousness, yeah. They must have some strategy behind this nonsense. I mean, you had coming on TV talking about how microwaves were listening to us, and then now this with windmill cancer. And I mean, this stuff is so absurd. Either they are just completely punking us, like this is all being filmed for the biggest reality TV movie extravaganza once they leave office, or something, or it's an effort to distract from something real, like him proposing several things that his own party gagged on, including closing the southern border and what was the other one? Obamacare. I mean,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that what this is? I mean, is this like, look over there, pay attention to this instead?
Cynically, I would say that, but I have come to the determination, and this is in with conversation with sources, with people that are in Washington that I've known for years and I have a tremendous amount of respect for, with Republicans in the Senate and the House that, believe it or not, I find that I have respect for. Everybody's come to the determination that essentially not only does the emperor not have any clothes, but the emperor's a moron. And that's pretty much what it's come down to, is that the President of the United States is a flaming effing idiot, and which is tragic. But, he's sitting in a place where he can generate action just simply by, opening up his mouth, such as, well, I'm going to close the border. It doesn't matter that the economic impact, on your country as well as mine, because let's face it, we eat avocados in Canada too, and I'm going to get into picking on my friends in the press for that one. But, I mean, if you start thinking about it and you look at it, it's just ridiculous. But these are the things that come sliding out of his mouth. Now, sometimes you do have to wonder whether or not, he is deflecting. And, of course, we do know that he goes out on these tangents after, especially bad news is headed his direction, such as the Mueller report or some of the other things. And if he gets criticism, we do know he has a tendency to go off the deep end there. But what's amazing to me is that in the unguarded moments where he isn't necessarily on defense, he comes out with statements like, windmill noise gives you cancer. So it's like,
right.
Okay. So it's hard, Rob. I mean, honestly, there's people in Washington that virtually shake their head at this. And again, every day is a fresh day. You don't know what's going to come out of that place next. You really don't.
Yeah. No. I hear you. I hear you. Speaking of the Mueller report, What is, uh-huh. and you I may be blindsiding you on this, but I saw things today where people who worked on the report itself are signaling that there's a lot more to it than has been released. What are you hearing about that?
My colleagues at the New York Times and especially at the Washington Post, they've had sources who are actual people that worked on the investigation have told them confidentially that there are sections of the report that were specifically written by the special counsel and his staff with the idea that those portions of the report were in fact going to be made public. So there are entire sections of the report that were written that way. The other part of it is that the Attorney General, when he wrote his he wrote basically a four-page summary, which was an essentially whitewash, according to sources at the Justice Department, and these are people who are talking to my colleagues at the Post, the New York Times, and Politico, that what's going on there is that things actually for Trump are a lot worse than Barr painted the picture of. And these were some of the things that hopelessly annoyed two very powerful chairmen of committees of the U.S. House of Representatives, Chairman Nadler and Chairman Cummings, on judiciary and oversight. So, you know, they've decided based on, you know, rather excellent reporting from my friends in D.C. that there's more to it and that they really need to do it. You know, at the end of the day, Barr was a person who wrote his own ticket to come on as Attorney General. He auditioned by writing a memorandum where he basically upheld what he saw as a wide-ranging a grouping of powers under presidential authority. And, of course, that was obviously going to attract someone like Trump, and it did. At the same time, you know, he's saying that the presidency has, you know, certain powers and should be immune to certain things, but you've got these prosecutors saying otherwise. And as I've said to you before, I think at the end of the day, you know, I don't think Trump will get impeached. I do think that the Democrats are rapidly running out of patience with him, but I don't see any move on the Hill to impeach him. And Speaker Pelosi has pretty strongly telegraphed and stated out loud she's not for an impeachment. So I think we're still headed for an extremely messy end to the Trump presidency over what's going to be probably one of the nastiest and bloodiest presidential campaign races that you have seen in your country's history. It's about to get really ugly. And then I think there's a good chance if what we're hearing in the, in, at least in my profession and our sources are telling us and our colleagues are telling us, what we do probably see that we are looking at an interesting scenario at 12:01 on, you know, January 20 of 2020, that there's a good chance that this guy is going to walk off the stage. He's the ex-president, and someone with the U.S. Marshal's uniform is going to slap cuffs on him and frog walk, perp walk his butt into a Suburban and not the helicopter, which would be a really nice scene for the American public to see. I don't think it necessarily will happen that way, but there is this possibility, and those will be directly related to charges coming out of the Southern District of New York, the U.S. Attorney up there, and also coming out of the New York State Attorney General's office on state charges. So there's still that open possibility. But I do want to caution our listeners. You know, I want to caution our listeners, Rob. This is not going to be a polite campaign. This is not going to be a nice campaign. This is going to be a lot uglier than anyone has ever seen before, ever in the history of American political races. And trust me, your country's had some really down and dirty political races for that office, but nothing that's going to come close to this one. And
are you talking about the campaign with Trump or the Democratic primary campaign?
Both. I'm going to go through the primary process, but because of Trump himself and the way he is, you know, the Republicans don't have anyone to replace him. He's going to continue to be, you know, tenacious, hanging in there till the bloody end, and he's going to make for an extremely bitter, divisive, even more so than normal for him, okay, back and forth on the campaign. And it's going to – you're going to see – negative attack ads that are going to go off the rail on both sides. It's just, this one's going to be really butt ugly. And at the end of the day,
right?
Okay, this presidency is just going to be a mess when it finally does end.
So, speaking of the campaign, and we will get to our LGBTQ topics, but I want to ask you about this one. The Biden stuff, what's your take on all that?
I think what the Vice President did, and I'm going to preface this with full transparency disclosure. I know the Vice President. I first encountered him when he was a United States Senator from Delaware. Joe Biden is an honorable man. He's a good guy. His wife, I have the utmost respect for Dr. Biden. I knew their son who passed away, Beau Biden, very honorable person. So professionally and personally, I have a lot of respect for him. Now, that said, he's from a different era. He's from a different way of thinking. He's from a different way of looking at things. And unfortunately, you know, things change and they evolve. Now, he put out a video on Twitter yesterday, I believe it was, in essence apologizing for the behavior that upset these women, and stating that he gets it and that he's going to make, you know, every effort to change his ways, as it were. Joe Biden is a very touchy-feely, genuine human being. And unfortunately, in today's era of Me Too, that quite frankly doesn't translate very well. And the other part of it is I honestly don't think, and I would be vehemently opposed to anyone categorizing anything that Joe Biden did as sexual harassment or you know, any kind of demeaning of women. That's just not him. He's a glad-handling politician from the old school, you know, an old Irish pole politician, you know, that harkens back to an earlier time. And as he pointed out in his video, you know, times do change and people change and circumstances change and culture and society change. You know, there's the extremes of it, okay? And for the people that are getting upset, you know, I would remind them that a certain word used against Black Americans, okay, was publicly acceptable 50 years ago in public, okay, for the most part, particularly in the South, and it is now the most toxic word on the face of the planet. Of course, I'm referring to the N-word. So, you know, that is a reflection of how things change and things evolve. And I do want to say, recognizing that today, sadly, is the 51st anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King at the age of 39. And the reason I'm going to mention that with Joe Biden in the same breath is because I think that a lot of the things that were characteristic to Dr. King of that era, if he had not been assassinated, and let's say he was of Biden's age in a particular time as things would be evolving forward, Dr. King would probably find himself getting into hot water too. Yeah, that's how much the dynamics of the conversation have changed.
Right. Now, here's my take on it, because I am pretty frustrated over this whole thing, and even frustrated to the point of being a little bit angry. When the Me Too movement launched, it brought up some things that were long overdue being brought up, which was a lot of women who were severely victimized that could not find a voice, could not get credibility, could not get anybody to listen to them or stand up for them when they had been raped and abused. And even the experience of many women just having to deal with lascivious treatment, you know, objectifying, especially in the workplace, and, you know, all of that. I thought that was right on. You know, we needed to clean that up. And a strong movement to make that happen is absolutely necessary. This has now, in my mind, crossed the line. And I have to look at the women that are making the complaints and have them take some responsibility here as well. And what I mean by that is the original woman who brought up the complaint, was running for lieutenant governor of Nevada.
Yes.
Or was it Nevada? Nevada. Okay. So
Nevada.
This is a leadership position. And to me, it's like where, you know, I'm not a touchy-feely person. I'm not the first person to go running and hugging people. And people who hug me, you know, out of the blue that I don't know very well, quite frankly, yeah, I'm a little bit, you know, it's not in my comfort zone. And I've had people in authority who have done that with me. But it's like, I know I have two choices. One is either to accept it and accept that their comfort level is different than mine. And two, if it's really out of line, to say, hey, you know, I'm not comfortable with that. And I don't care who they are. And if somebody is vying for a leadership position but cannot take that simple act of assertion, then I think she needs to understand or examine her own qualifications. I'm sorry. It's like I don't buy that is so intimidating. That is not the same thing as somebody demanding a secret sexual favor, you know, in terms of holding your position or keeping it. And I also find a double standard in terms of what is expected of men, where the complaint is that men are too rigid, too, you know, macho, you know, not showing affection or their feelings. And then you have somebody who has got this reputation of being, you know, emotive and accessible and everything else. Yeah, then some people are going to find that too much. But that is part of dealing with our humanity, is that people are not going to fit into neat little boxes. You know, it's not going to be just the right amount of public affection and asking permission before, you know, before communicating something. In the case where it was described, I totally believe her. I totally believe that it happened. But what I heard was a senior politician giving her a strong communication of, I believe in you, and Dad is here right behind you. And, you know, it's, I'm sorry, the way that it was brought up publicly in a sense of public shaming, I'm not a fan of. I am not buying into this one. So that's my
concern. Well, the problem, there are quite a few people that, you know, I think fit into that same, you know, tracking. I can remember several times where, you know, the vice president or at the time then Senator Biden would emphasize a point, and he would put his, you know, hand on my shoulder and he would lean in and he would talk to me, and I didn't feel threatened by that. And then again, I get it, because I'm from a generation where, you know, that type of thing, you saw that growing up with. With the women folk and with what's been going on, particularly within the Democratic Party, there's such a balkanization, right? And I've said this many, many, many times. One of the reasons the right's always so successful is because they could be stabbing each other in the back, who's stepping down the boulevard, holding the knife in the other one's back, you know, while they're dripping, with a smile on their face, and they stay on message. Whereas with the left, it's virtually herding cats in a parade.
It does.
But we live in an era where the polarization swings either way too far to the left or way too far to the right. And that point of moderation, which in many cases is a point of common sense, seems to have been lost. And one of the reasons that it has been lost is more than just the non-assertiveness of some of the women folk or men folk or anyone that's been, you know, dealing with it. But quite frankly, you are looking, and I will point the finger, at the polarization and the divisiveness that the right wing has imposed on everyone, including people that I would identify as center-right. You know, the extremism of the religious right in the United States, and you marry that to the extremism of some of the political processes, and these are the results. And suddenly there's so much divisiveness, and people get entirely too touchy. And what at one point would have been, you know, a norm of sorts, or not quite something that would give offense, or something that wasn't about to cause, you know, this kind of reaction, now suddenly is triggering. I don't like using that word because that's a word that is overused. But in this particular case, it does fit, and it's the triggering process. And I think that the biggest thing is people need to take a pause, take a deep breath, step back, and take a look at the context of the situation. And that's the biggest problem that I've discovered in the last 15 years, more than any other, with the American culture, society, and the political environment. Americans have lost their sense of the context of their own politics and of their own culture and of their own society. And the minute you lose sight of that, okay, you suddenly get, you know, it's like pushing two magnets together with different polarities, and you try that on the same polarity level. What happens to the magnets? They will literally separate as fast as they can from each other. But if you put a positive with a minus, they won't do that. Well, we've got positive, you know, all over your country right now, and these batteries are shooting, these magnets are shooting as far apart as possible. I think that's kind of tragic, because what happens is there's so much noise about this, the people lose the context of the larger message. And more importantly, I think that they lose the context of what's really, truly going on. They're so busy arguing about this that they're missing the larger picture. And, you know, that's really, I think, at the end of the day, Rob, that's the problem.
Well, yeah, and it is really ironic, because you've got this one world where they're worrying about whether you know, coming up and, you know, doing a fatherly kiss on the back of the head is criminal and horrible. And on the other side, you know, you've got completely ignoring, you know, sleeping with prostitutes and porn stars and, you know, grabbing women by the genitalia and bragging about it and, you know, being completely, you know, unscathed by that behavior. And it's just like, it's just bizarre. But Brody, I want to get to some of our topics tonight, mm-hmm. otherwise we never will.
Sure.
So let's start with the two states, the two T's. The two T's going after anti-LGBTQ laws, Texas and Tennessee. What's up
there? Well,
let's start
with Tennessee. The Tennessee House of Representatives, that's the lower body of the House, has passed a bill that would allow adoption providers in that state to discriminate against LGBT people, particularly, you know, same-sex couples who are married or partnered. And basically what this bill will do, and it was passed along party lines on a 67-22 vote on Monday, is that the bill would permit adoption and foster care agencies to reduce services to same-sex couples. And they base it, okay, on individuals or, you know, agencies' religious or moral convictions. So it's the same old tired, you know, meme. But the thing is there's a catch-all with this. And the focus of these anti-gay people in this particular case are really vehement, and I'll call him for what he is. He's a homophobe named Representative Tim Rudd. This is going to catch Muslim couples and couples that are maybe even possibly Jewish or Hindu or other faiths besides gays or lesbian same-sex couples or mixed orientation marriages and catch them up in it, because it literally becomes the whole thing of, well, if I have a well-founded religious or moral conviction that says I shouldn't have these people, you know, adopt a child, this law basically says, you know, that, you know, we can allow that. And it's basically, you know, the latest in a string of states that have passed almost identical freedom to discriminate adoption laws. I don't think people realize, but these laws are already on the books in Alabama, Kansas, Michigan, Mississippi, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, and Texas. So Tennessee just really is just kind of joining the bandwagon. There's also a similar measure in the Georgia House. You know, at the end of the day, okay, is that they're kind of they're kind of putting this into the frame of context. And Rudd said this in an interview he did with the Tennessean, which is the state's largest newspaper. And I'm quoting him. He said, "We're doing the same as nine other states have done. You know, throughout the country, these faith-based organizations have been sued to the point that they're being driven out of business due to costs." Well, that's a misnomer, okay? They're being sued out of existence because of their discriminatory practices. But the Christian right has become very adept at changing that around, especially in court, and paint the picture that this is religious discrimination. And now, since we mentioned Texas, we should go to the next state that just got really bad.
Well, before you do, Brody, because I want to, I want to reemphasize my major issue being a foster care parent and, you know, having been through the adoption system. What is this discrimination? The thing that bothers me most about it is not the upfront discrimination against an LGBTQ couple per se. I mean, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's robbing a child of a potentially, wonderful home. There's a lot wrong in that process. But to me, the other thing is what's not being said here, which is kids who are in these systems who themselves are LGBTQ, and they need to be placed in homes that are supportive and nurturing to who they are automatically being subjected in these particular organizations to couples who obviously have this other kind of agenda. And that aspect is what really scares me. And to me, in the future, that is where this is going to blow right open, is we're going to start having kids who will come out and start telling the stories of how they were subjected to religious homes and oppressed and harmed, and that those homes should have been evaluated appropriately. And this system, inspires that. So anyway, that's my two cents there on Detective.
No, your two cents is right. And actually, I'm gonna pick up that thread and run with it just a little bit longer. It's a serious enough problem, because what ends up happening is that it makes older teens and adolescents who are out, they're stuck in a foster care system until they age out at age 18, because no one's going to adopt them. Or if they, are fortunate enough to get adopted and they get one of these proselytizing super evangelical families, which is probably extremely likely, especially in the American South, it's going to be the never ceasing try and pray the gay away crap. Although fortunately conversion therapy is rapidly getting outlawed, unfortunately some of that's what the religious conservatives have, they've labeled it in a misnomer of talk therapy, although it's not even what that is. So, the kids get exposed, to that. The net result is that we're going to see either a maintaining of the levels of suicides by LGBTQ kids between the ages of 14 and 24, or we're probably going to see an uptick in it. And the biggest thing that comes down to this at the end of the day is, and this is really, this is the point that kind of angers me more than anything else, is the hypocrisy of these so-called Christians. These are the same people that, are constantly railing against abortion. Yeah, okay, fine. So you do away with abortion, and suddenly, you have all these unwanted children being born. And then, of course, you are also fiscally responsible and want smaller government, so you're not going to pay for services for these kids. It becomes a never-ending cycle. At the end of the day, and if you're Christian and you're listening to our show and you get offended, quite frankly, I don't care. Because you people have gotten away with this crap.
And you can take solace that I am a Christian too, so there. For those who are
Yeah, for those of you that are gonna get insulted, it's just, I don't care. Because at the end of the day, your evil religion has run its course. Okay. There's nothing good about Christianity in the United States. Period. And it's laws like this, that illustrate the point. You know, these kids, okay, I mean, taking the possibility of a loving, nurturing home away from a child, okay, because you believe in Bronze Age mythology that was written by a bunch of goat-fucking sheep herders, still mystifies me. I don't get that. It's the 21st century, Rob. Speaking of which,
no,
let's talk about Texas. You know, Texas, my next...
But quickly, because we've got some mayors to talk about, too, here. So.
Oh, yeah, we're going to talk about some mayors. Texas has passed a bill in the Senate. It's extremely controversial. It's the Senate Bill 17. They passed it on a vote of 19 to 12 on Tuesday. This bill, which was submitted by another rabid evangelical type, Senator Charles Perry, would bar professional licensing bodies in Texas from taking action against individuals, okay, who violate professional standards on discrimination as long as they assert religious justification for doing so. What that basically translates into, in Texas, if you're a teacher, doctor, firefighter, architect, dental director, building inspector, social worker, counselor, psychologist, therapist, judge, veterinarian, pipe fitter, auditor, surgeons, blah, 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 if you don't like gay people, you can legitimately say, I'm not going to serve them, okay? You're in a car wreck, you're on the side of the road, okay, the EMT comes bailing out to come save your life, sees a pride sticker on the back of your car, asks you if you're conscious if you're gay, or sees a, you know, a pride flag or something on you or a tattoo. He can stand up at that point and go, not doing this one. I have a religious objection to this person's gay and walking away. This law would protect them. Okay. And need I say anything more about this, Rob?
No, I think we've covered this topic. I think, surprise, and we'll watch it. But let's go to history making. We have a new mayor in Chicago who is African American and lesbian and a woman, which I guess lesbian and a woman is sort of a little bit redundant, but breaking the glass ceiling. Let's talk about the new mayor of Chicago.
Well, this is the second time, okay, a major city in the United States has had a openly gay mayor. Now, previously, as we know, that distinction was held by Houston, Texas, and my good friend Anise Parker, who was mayor from 2010 until 2016. Anise, by the way, is now the executive director of the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund in Washington. And I'm going to quote something that Anise said, because I think this is really true. A black lesbian taking power in the nation's third largest city is a historic moment for so many communities that are often too ignored in American politics. Chicago's enormous influence on the national dialogue provides a platform for Lori, the newly elected mayor, to promote more inclusive solutions to the challenges facing our cities and nation, and to be a credible messenger as well. Lori will certainly remain focused on the issues facing Chicago, but as the highest-ranking LGBTQ person ever elected mayor of an American city, a title she now takes from me, she is also a key leader in the movement to build LGBTQ political power nationwide. And the thing is that Mayor Lightfoot has done an amazing job. And Chicago and Chicago politics, when you consider that the mayor that she replaced was Rahm Emanuel, former congressman, chief of staff for President Obama, and a powerhouse in his own right, it is significant that the segue went from the white male dominant structure to her. And I think particularly given Chicago, and I'll point a finger to Chicago police as related to the latest mess with shootings of young, you know, unarmed black males, and of course the Justice Smollett mess. It's kind of a critical time in Chicago's history for Mayor Lightfoot to be taking power, and I think it's kind of important. Now, interestingly enough, she wasn't the only one that night. Satya Rose Conaway is now the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, also a rather large city. And in Kansas City, Missouri, Jolie Justice, okay, is now in a runoff with Quentin Locust in the general election, which I think is really important. But what's really interesting is that, you know, Sata Rose Conway in Madison is another open lesbian and will actually be Madison, Wisconsin's first openly gay mayor. And I will note, Madison is the area of Wisconsin that Wisconsin senior Senator Tammy Baldwin represented in the U.S. House before she took over and won her election as a senator. So this is really kind of interesting. Not only are we seeing women in power, but we're seeing lesbians in power, and we're seeing them in power in Wisconsin in particular, in an area that's not been terribly blue recently, and it's Chicago, where you've just had one problem after the other. And I commend both Mayor Conway as well as Mayor Lightfoot on their victories.
Well, you know, I actually look at this and, you know, we were talking a few minutes ago about Trump and, you know, throwing out distractions. And I think in the bigger picture, I think something's going to play out here that is going to one day shock the hell out of the Trump supporter base. And that is that while the media has been focusing on Trump's ups and downs and, you know, he's in every news cycle and everything else, slowly the grassroots has been the complete antithesis of the Trump picture, where we have people across the nation taking roles, people who have been marginalized by, you know, the Trump philosophy and the quote unquote make America quote unquote great again, which is a, you know, a dog whistle to reverting it back to the ultimate in white privilege, that it is the country will wake up and find that the whole country has turned into something very, very different. And that is going to seemingly happen while they weren't watching, but it is happening step by step by step. And case in point, to show where this could go, let's look at the other gay mayor from Indiana, Mayor Pete, who is number three in a lot of the polls and caucuses for the Democratic nomination. And to what you pointed out to me offline, polling has indicated that many, many, many people are not worried about the fact that he's gay.
That's true. That's true. I think it's interesting. I was talking, I talk to pollsters. It's part of my job. I was talking to pollsters from a highly respected Quinnipiac University poll. I've been talking to pollsters from Reuters. I've been talking, of course, to Gallup folks and the folks at 538, Nate Silver's outfit. And one of the most interesting things that we're seeing, particularly in the grassroots, and this is with independent voters, who are going to be the key critical vote when it comes into play in this election coming up and in the primary process. But Mayor Pete's sexual orientation, really, that's not bothering them too much. It's kind of a shrug. Oh, he's gay. Okay, fine. You know, it's really with him, I think part of it is because he articulates it so well, but it's all about issues. It's about solving issues. It's about resolving issues. It's about looking at things, you know, in a particular way. And let's face it, you know, the man's a Rhodes Scholar. He's super sharp. He's also someone who's put the uniform of the United States on. He's a counterterrorist expert with the U.S. Navy Reserve. I believe he's a lieutenant, an O3. So this is someone who is also pretty much a consensus builder. I had an opportunity to talk to people from Indiana who know the mayor and know of him, and virtually everyone has said the same thing, that his tenure in office in South Denton, this is a city that has been so negatively impacted with economic downturn and the loss of heavy industry over the last 40 years, it's got some problems. It's got, you know, it really is kind of an example, if you will, of the problems running through that part of the country. You know, the opiate crisis, high unemployment, particularly with the minority communities. And Mayor Pete just keeps slugging away and hands on and does his best. And South Bend has slowly but surely been turning around. And one thing that I keep hearing from everybody in Indiana with the mayor is what you see is what you get. And that's probably the highest compliment that I can think of. The only other person right now, and he's not even declared yet, in the Democratic races that would probably also fit that description, is the aforementioned we were just speaking about, Vice President, former VP Joe Biden.
That was what occurs to me with Mayor Pete is because you and I've talked, and you know you've raised your concern about apart from everything else, the age of Joe Biden. You know, everything else being equal. And here we have a candidate who exudes a lot of the same confidence and intelligence and accessibility and so many different qualities and has freshness. So, I'm glad you agree, Brody. Thank you very much. Sorry.
It's okay.
Reacting to your sound effect in the background there. Sorry.
Unfortunately, audience, I have puppies, and puppies make lots of noise. So for
no, that was very well timed. Yeah.
It was really good, actually. The puppies lit up at the right time. I think that for what you're seeing with Mayor Pete. And I've said this to you before, and I think that this is kind of important. We're looking at the context. And 60 years ago, a young United States senator from Massachusetts, also someone who wore, ironically enough, the uniform of the United States Navy, was considered a hero. A very articulate, polished scholar, spokesperson from a wealthy to-do family, being about the biggest difference between him and Mayor Pete, you know, ended up being inaugurated as President of the United States, and it was the youth and the vigor, and in his inaugural address, President Kennedy said, the torch has been passed. Well, I think the United States is at a moment in its history, and this is critical, politically, as well as the culture and society, that the torch needs to be passed. I have tremendous respect for Joe Biden. I have tremendous respect for Elizabeth Warren. I have tremendous respect for Bernie Sanders. Okay, I have interviewed these people. I have dealt with these people over the years as U.S. senators on the Hill. Ms. Warren previously. I have a lot of respect for them. But at the end of the day, they're going to be out there that tomorrow morning will be writing nasty letters to the editor about Levesque being an ageist. I'm not being an ageist. I just think it's time that the torch is passed. I really honestly truly believe that you do have limitations, and this is a limitation that, you know, speaking truth to power and speaking truth to power is talking to the American people. You folks seriously need to put younger people in office. You need to get fresh ideas, and you have to have people who have a fresh perspective. I don't care if it's Mayor Pete or Senator Kamala Harris or Senator Booker, you know, it's the time. The time has come. The era of having the same folks in power year after year, decade after decade after decade, you know, it doesn't do your country any good. And I quite frankly, at the end of the day, I think what ends up happening is that is a major contributor to the divisiveness of the political system. Because when you look at these people's background, Rob, these people have been sitting in Senate seats and governorships and House seats and political power of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the, you know, the DCCC and the RNCCC forever. And what ends up happening is it becomes stagnation. It becomes all about collecting of power and collecting of money. And the voice of the people gets lost in the white noise of that. This is one reason that I probably let out the biggest sigh of relief that Hillary Clinton said she wasn't going to run again. That was one of those thank God moments. You know, it's time.
Yeah.
It really is time. I think you guys need to go back to what Jack Kennedy did 60 years ago, okay? And it's time you guys, you know, you did a do-over. You did a restart. You do politics 3.0. Because if you guys keep using, you know, Microsoft Windows 95, sooner or later the shit's going to crash. And that's what's happening. That's my take.
Well, I'm not quite on the throw out all the old people bandwagon as you are. But that being said, I do think we need, because some of the problems that are on the table are not respected as deeply by older generation people, like global warming and climate change and things that I think younger people are taking a much harder look at because they are going to have to deal with it for a lot longer. So that added perspective of relevancy, I think makes it valid. I would like to see diversity, not necessarily all one or the other, but anyway, let's move on though to probably one of our last cases here, which is the Mad King from I'm going to forget the name of it.
Brunei, yes. We're talking about Sultan Hassanal. Yes. Hassanal Bolakaya, or basically known just as the Sultan of Brunei. More than likely, he probably is the wealthiest person on the face of the planet, and he is implementing, or did implement as of Wednesday, the last stage of Sharia law, which is a very primitive, worse than Bronze Age application of radical Islam. Actually, it's according to some of the Islamic scholars that I've spoken to, it's a deeply flawed interpretation. And once again, it's, you know, the same thing that, you know, those who can scream the loudest in the temple usually get their way. And it's across all, you know, bands of religiosity. And unfortunately, in this case, in Brunei, this is true. Now, this started in 2014.
I want to ask two questions, though, just so we get some framework here. The hell is Brunei?
It's in the archipelago. It's in the archipelago of Micronesia, and the it rides the cusp between the Malaysian area and it's basically between the Indian and Pacific Oceans in that area of what would be termed Southeast Asia. It's basically a flyspeck. Okay. Go ahead.
And how did he get so rich? I'm sure it has to do with oil, but why is he in particular, even compared to all the other Saudi, you know, wealth and all that, why is he so wealthy?
I think that the principal reason is because of oil, and it was just kind of a weird thing. Like I said, Brunei is actually sits on the Malaysian island of Borneo. It's just kind of a really tiny flyspeck of an area. It just was oil. Oil was kind of what was put them on the map, and you know, this guy kind of used that to facilitate and acquire great wealth. And as a direct result, it's one of those things that people have a tendency to kind of look at and go, really, this little tiny flyspeck, you know, did this. It's developed into an industrialized country, but the main base of its wealth are extensive petroleum and natural gas, and that's really the base of the economy and its wealth right there. And because the Sultan literally controls everything, you know, it's virtually all this money flows into his coffers at some point. He is literally
right.
The government, you know.
This is the second time he's been boycotted. It raised up again because he pushed things to such a horrific, drastic level in his country. What happened with the last boycott?
It petered out. And there's no other polite way of putting it. The Sultan actually started this action in October of 2013, and he announced that he was implementing Sharia law at that point. And just for listeners who don't know what Sharia calls for punishments, we're talking public flogging of women who have abortions, Amputation of Limbs for Thieves, and of course then Death by Stoning for persons convicted of having, quote, homosexual sex. Now, in 2014, the celebrities all got together, including Jay Leno and Ellen and Elton John and a few others, and they declared a boycott of the Dorchester Collection of properties. Now, these are extremely high-end five-star hotels, and they're owned by a company that's called the Brunei Investment Agency, or BIA, and they, in turn, have one owner, and that's the Sultan. So Clooney and DeGeneres and Elton John and Leno and James Duke Mason and Cleve Jones and all these people put out this huge protest. And then not even a year later, and I'm going to quote from my friends at The Hollywood Reporter, this is a direct quote, "Maybe the siren call of those McCarthy salads at the Polo Lounge is just too tempting. Less than a year after Hollywood loudly boycotted the Beverly Hills Hotel, after its owner, the Sultan of Brunei, implemented the anti-gay Sharia law in his country, some film industry types are creeping back, making it safe. Visitors who are either out or maintain close ties to the community." And that included a producer,
right.
Cyrus, people like that. So what ended up happening was
they
all the stories in 2014, and a year later, nothing.
Right. And also there was a backlash on it. I remember Rose McGowan in particular and others came out saying they didn't like him, but they loved the staff and that it was hurting the staff. You know, the boycott
mm-hmm.
was hurting, you know, good people, you know, in inadvertently. You know, so I think that's the question. We're actually running out of time here, so we can't really belabor the point. But we'll see how this boycott goes, whether, you know, it actually takes this time. I would think that it needs something bigger, you know, I mean, something almost legal that to make it illegal for him to do business in the United States, you know, with being a huge violator of human rights. You know, it's just unconscionable.
Well, we're running out of time. We only got a couple of minutes, but I do want to make a couple of comments on that. A State Department spokesperson told Michael Labors from the Washington Blade that the United States is concerned with Brunei's decision to implement pages 2 and 3 of the Penal Code. Some of the punishments are inconsistent with international human rights obligations in respect to torture or other cruel or inhumane or degrading punishments. The problem is there's nothing that has any teeth. And with this particular administration, I really don't think you're going to see anything. So at the end of
right.
the day, we're probably not going to.
And that'll be the final word on that. I want to thank my co-host, Brody Levesque, for his insight and brilliance, as always. Thank you so much, Brody. I want to thank our listeners.
Sure.
We love you, and we will be here again next week, bringing you more topics and guests that you won't hear anywhere else. And also, listen to Out in Santa Cruz on Saturday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. You listen to that on www.ksco.com. This week, we will be playing a show with an interview with Bryn Tannehall and everything you want to know about being trans, but we're afraid to ask, and you want to hear that show. It is informative, it is insightful, and we welcome your listenership there. So as always, from Rated LGBT Radio, we will be back here again next week with a lot more. Tune in then. We can't wait.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.